people can't take public transport instead of a car if there isn't any public transport. People can't go and build their own buses or trains. This requires government, whether we like it or not. So it takes government investment.
Thanks very much for joining me for today's episode of the Front Footing the Future interview series in our quest to get climate policy fit for purpose. I'm Lindsay Wood. I'm the director of climate strategy company Resilience, and I'll be your host for 20 interviews with experts in different aspects of the climate crisis. Let's get on to today's episode with Dr. Catherine Knight. Today's guest, Dr. Catherine Knight, needs little introduction as she joined us on climate matters earlier in the year. However, to quickly recap, Catherine has a PhD in, believe it or not, the historical relationship between black bears and humans in Japan. She's an honorary research associate in public policy at Massey University, has an extensive CV, and has written a number of acclaimed books exploring how people relate to the environment, including An Uncommon Land, which is also the name of her Substack newsletter. And most recently, she spearheaded the highly successful Reality of Everything Symposium in late June. A very warm welcome back to Climate Matters, Catherine. Once again, we have plenty to discuss.
Thank you, Lindsay. Nice to be here.
Great stuff. I'm looking forward to our conversation. I can't resist, first of all, because I didn't do this last time. I want you to put my curiosity to rest about your PhD on black bears and people in Japan. Can you just give us a little background on how you came to study that relationship?
Yes, it's a bit random, isn't it, Lindsay? So my first degree, my undergraduate degree, I undertook at a Japanese university. So by the end of that time, I was pretty much fluent in Japanese and I was living in Japan. When I was thinking about, well, what further studies I can do once back in New Zealand, I was in Canterbury and I ended up doing a master's. And because of my background in Japan, it just flowed. So my master's was actually on the paradox of veneration, the paradox between the veneration and destruction of nature in Japan, and looking at the strange paradox, the strange tension between those two things. When I was looking for a topic for my PhD, but this topic struck me as a good one because it was all about, you know, conflict, paradox, and intention. And also it was highly multidisciplinary. So it covered history, it covered anthropology, it covered archaeology, geography and policy, government institutions, and exploring connections between things and disciplines. So the black bear was, and its habitat, and the relationship with humans was a great way to explore the Japanese perception and relationship with nature as a whole. And it was utterly fascinating. Also allowed me to reflect a lot on our New Zealand relationship. Our relationship as New Zealanders with nature and the environment, and led me to discover that a lot of the things I'd been sort of grown up believing weren't necessarily true either. So
how cool. And in a way, the black bear and human thing is almost like a little metaphor or cameo for a lot of your work since, which has dealt with the relationship between people and the environment, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we don't have anything quite as enigmatic as black bears roaming around, but yeah, there's lots of paradox and lots of tension and conflict in our environmental history.
Wonderful. We're lucky to have you so engaged in it. Thanks, Catherine. Rolling on to the Reality of Everything Symposium, you and I first penciled in this interview when we talked last time in the planning stages of the symposium, and we knew that it would be worth debriefing, and in a way, that's what this timing is driven by. As you know, I was there and I really found it worthwhile, even though I did get trapped in the vile weather that was in Wellington at the time. The fog came down at the airport while I was waiting for my plane. However, I'd like to start just by asking you to quickly outline for us the form that the symposium took and what were any high-level takeaways from your perspective.
Yes, certainly. So it was a game of two halves, as they say. So the morning part was these what we called expert talks or expert briefings on a range of topics from climate change, food security, public health, public finance, insurance retreat, te tiriti, etc. There was more limited scope for engagement from the audience, but we Mentimeter was very a tool for engagement was very skillfully used by our facilitators, Dr. Anne Bardsley and Dr. Catherine Dyer. So that enabled people to engage in the topics and what they were hearing. Then the afternoon was far more about the engagement of the people there and far more participant-led. So we had a session on deliberative democracy, introducing these tools and hearing a lot from the audience and opening out to discussion. And then there was a session led around transforming reality into action. And that was led by the Wellbeing Economy Alliance Aotearoa. And that was very much, there were breakout groups and it was very much, again, participant-led discussion. Yeah, so that was the format. And some takeaways. Well, I was utterly, basically, it exceeded my expectations. The day exceeded my expectations. And a lot of that came down to actually the caliber of. This is going to sound strange, but it came down to the caliber of the delegates, the people that actually came. I was astonished by this extremely high level of awareness, and what I also thought was absolutely fantastic and bodes well for continuing this conversation is that people were came from across broad sectors of society. So there were people in education and health, there were bankers, there were architects, there were engineers, and of course there were politicians and policymakers. Lots of people actually, especially live streamed in from government departments, interestingly enough. So that was amazing. And we're going to chat a little bit later too about input people provided in the through the Mentimeter results. So we'll chat about that a bit later. But as I say, the quality and the thoughtfulness of the contributions from the attendees, like it blew my mind. It was absolutely fantastic. So I was really thrilled by that. And you've already mentioned the weather, Lindsay. The other thing that utterly astonished me was how overwhelmed. I was utterly overwhelmed by the demand. And just so finally, I think my sense from my major takeaway in terms of this high level of demand from people to be there, I think for me it demonstrated that there's a strong appetite for honest conversations about the future. And I also sense that people are seeing past the empty promises of, technohopium and that technology is going to save us all and we just need to put our hope in that. And the final thing I would say, and we'll chat about this a bit more later, is that I've been inundated with requests for follow-up events around the motu, and including an invitation from members of parliament from both sides of the House, Labor and National, to have an event at parliament next month. So I think that's pretty good.
Oh, that's well, I hadn't heard that. That's wonderful, and that's also a big credit to you because it's not always easy to gate crash into Parliament and to get that from both sides. Well done. Rolling on from there, you mentioned that one of the events or one of the speakers was a brief exploration of deliberative democracy, and then a bit of time in the afternoon with Mentimeter. So perhaps you would explain a little bit what was going on in the other. The other platform that was mentioned was Polis. And so maybe a lot of listeners won't have a clue what mentimeter and polis refer to. Could you just touch base on what they are and then maybe give us your takeaway on the deliberative democracy aspect? And perhaps if you would, just say what the follow-up is hoped to be for it. I'd be interested in that.
Absolutely. So before I do so, I need to just qualify by this by saying that I'm by no means an expert. I'm learning as I go from the experts, which is Dr. Anne Bardsley, who you know yourself,
Yes, indeed.
and Dr. Catherine Dyer. So they led these parts of the symposium and the follow through as well. But so I think probably the important thing before fixating too much on the tools, which is, for example, Mentimeter and Polis, is to say that really all these tools are is enabling tools, and it could be these tools or it could be other tools, quite frankly, could be swapped out to enable participant-led conversations about what we're facing now and the future, and into. And it's very consensus driven, especially Polis, which we'll chat about a little bit more. So it's all about, as we know, on social media, just about everything, communication society these days is very much focused on seeding division. And what these tools do is it's all about seeding consensus and finding common ground between people who may have quite different value sets, might support different political parties, but it's all about finding that sort of common ground. So incredibly healthy, and an antidote to the seeding of division that we're seeing through so many other aspects of our world, and especially digital world today. That said, so as you say, at the symposium itself, a tool called Mentimeter was used, and I'm not really an expert on this, but it was really just about capturing, enabled people to capture statements and questions and so on, and see each other's, and then they were able to make word clouds, and they were also were able to make reports that could thematically analyze what people were saying. And so these are really tremendously powerful tools. So that was used in the session itself, the Mentimeter, and live streamers were able to also use it. So it was fantastic. Now Polis was discussed, and again, this is a, I believe, an open source tool, so it's not a proprietary tool. It's open source and free to use, developed by researchers in the States, and that is the tool that that we're proposing to use in a follow up to this. And using, so you start this conversation, I guess, in quote marks, off with seed statements. And so those seed statements people can see, and they can agree or disagree, or they can propose their own. And then eventually you get to a place where you find consensus around different themes.
Can I pause you just briefly?
Yes, sure.
Can you just give an example of what you mean by a seed statement?
Absolutely. So basically, so I actually have here in front of me, Lindsay, a list of potential seed statements that were drawn out of the Mentimeter input from the day. And what Anne has done is then sorted them thematically under things like governance, democracy, economic system, food systems, land use, etc. These can be either, they can be statements, or they can be, sometimes they're questions, but mainly I think they're statements. And sometimes they're about what needs to happen, and sometimes they are proposing, actions. And they can be quite general, or they can be quite specific. So, to give you an example of a seed statement that was offered by a member, someone who was attending under system change slash governance, one example is: citizens' assemblies can improve complex decision making. So that was one example under governance and system change. Under economic system, for example, There was a statement, the resources of the rich and well-off need to be used to transition to a sustainable society and economy, whether they like it or not. There are many good examples. Another one was a country's first priority should be making sure it has the resources it needs to support its people, not competing internationally to maximize private profits was another one. Under, for example, food systems, and there were loads in land use, there were loads of it's really hard to choose actually from these because they were all fantastic, to be quite honest. But one example there was a food producing nation like Aotearoa should be able to provide sufficient healthy food for its own people. Another one that I really liked, which was under the theme individual versus systemic action, was the single most effective action an individual can make in response to climate change is to form a collective and lobby for structural change, which is kind of what it's all about. And look, there are so many more that I could share with you, but there are some examples. So what we're likely to do when we launch the POLIS is to start off with, we think about 50 or so of these seed statements, which will be based on the ones that were generated on the day, and then work from there and see where it takes us. And just to sort of emphasize, this is entirely participant-led. It's not the facilitators of the POLIS shaping it. It's entirely the participants. And the idea,
Can I interrupt briefly there and just pick up a couple of things? One is for those listeners who are thinking, oh, those statements all sound skewed towards social outcomes. I think we can look on them as challenges, can't we? That here's a statement. It's not saying you have to say, yes, I agree with it. It's a prompt for a discussion around that theme. Am I framing that reasonably?
Exactly. Oh, 100%. Actually, you've brought up an extremely good point because this was a question for me as well. So I'm not even sure whether I can find it here, but there was a statement around one action that we can all take is switch to veganism. And this was discussed apparently on the day. I was unfortunately not in the room because I was busy organizing the next session. But there was this amazing discussion. And we might choose to agree or disagree with that statement, but it's still creating this seed for discussion. And so whether or not we agree or disagree, it's really valuable, a very valuable starting point. And so, yes, you're exactly right. It's not about us saying, oh, here are some statements that we're all going to force people to agree with. It's about having a discussion about the statements.
So, as an architect, I could put out a statement like saying, the most environmental sort of accommodation is the igloos. We should all live in igloos. I mean, we all know that that's a nonsense, but it's a spur for discussion.
Exactly. And what a great no. So, well, that was really about it. And so we've had some technical challenges just getting a server. So, we're hoping that this is going to, become a national, enable a national, facilitate a national conversation. But the flip side of that is that you really need to be technically, logistically prepared. And so it was about, lining out a server that would have enough capacity to run the POLIS platform. If it just snowballs out and, we have next minute, we have 5 million people participating. So we needed to sort through those issues but we're looking on track for it all to be, we're really hoping that we can get this initiated hopefully next month, but it will be updating people via the website and
And before we wrap up today, at the end, I'll ask you to give people means of contacting how they follow up all of these things.
Yes,
Great
great.
stuff.
Yes, great. No, the only other thing I wanted to say was because I find this etymology really interesting. POLIS the word which has a dot in it before the IS. I'm assuming, I don't know, I haven't looked into this, but I'm assuming it's from the word for the Greek city-state, the ancient Greek word for city-state. And that might seem a bit arbitrary and random, but actually the city-state was the sort of genesis of democracy. And polis is the root of the word politikos, meaning of, for, or relating to citizens or the affairs of the cities. So we might think polis is a bit a strange word, but actually it's the root of politics.
And if you think of it, it's the end of metropolis, isn't it? So it's the same. Some listeners may recall a couple of years ago, I reported on an interview between Nate Hagans and the Taiwanese Minister of Digital Affairs, Audrey Tang. And Audrey went into polis and said how great it was, just as you were saying about bringing together people instead of dividing them and so on. So excellent. Really look forward to seeing how that rolls out, Catherine. Talking about rolling out, we're rolling towards an election this year. And we've got an interview today that I'm like to be centered on climate policy. What policy settings would you most like to see on the table ahead of the coming election? Can you give us a Catherine Knight insight there, please?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one overall, I guess, statement of the obvious is that it appears, in the last few years, we seem to have completely given up as a country on climate mitigation and are only weakly addressing climate adaptation. So that's got to change quite clearly. So I would like to see immediate measures put in place to reduce climate emissions, emphasizing, and I think this is really important, emphasizing to New Zealanders that these measures will have meaningful benefits in terms of other aspects of people's lives and the economy, such as the cost of living, public health, environmental health. And it will make us economically more resilient. And it's really important people understand these, so-called co-benefits. At a government level, I would like to see a broad suite of incentives and support for the things we want to see more of, such as low carbon transport, more efficient use of energy, reduced food waste, right to repair, and reduced agricultural emissions. And flip side of the incentives, I'd like to see disincentives for the things we want our economy to do less of. So that is fossil fuel consumption, agricultural emissions, waste generation, and just noting we have one of the highest rates per capita of waste generation in the world, which is quite shameful.
I did not know that.
It's very high. It's our per capita, generation of waste in the OECD, and just a reduction of disincentivizing waste of resources generally. I think we're far too complacent about limited resources, whether it be energy, whether it be water or land, or any other manner of things. In fact, materials.
And I just said, before you roll on,
Yes.
can I just say that Christina Hood was who I interviewed as well. You probably know Christina. She was very much on the same wavelength on some of those things. So keep going.
Well, that's brilliant to know, Lindsay, because she's a real expert when it comes to this. Again, I'm a generalist. She's a real expert, and she's especially an expert on the next thing I'm going to mention, but only in general terms. So, more specifically, the emissions trading scheme, which established to put a price on carbon, is utterly broken. I'm sure she talked about this. It has been completely undermined by successive government actions, and the fact that major greenhouse gas producing sectors are not part of it. And so I think there needs to be a consistent and trusted signal across the economy for the price of carbon so that people, whether it be farmers, whether it be industry or businesses, can invest in the actions that they know will pay off in the long run, both financially and for the climate. And I think this is where we need to see much more maturity in our democratic system and our governance. We need bipartisan commitment to long-term carbon budgets, as was the case in the UK. But sadly, when we brought in the Zero Carbon Act, we modelled it on their legislation, but that binding aspect of it we didn't bring through. There wasn't the appetite for it, and I think we are losing as a result of that. We've lost out on,
Agreed.
yeah. And I just wanted to say as well, just so because this is highly apolitical, what I'm saying, ironically, it was the National Government Environment Minister Simon Upton, who first proposed a carbon tax in the 1990s. And I often, and, but there was ma major pushback for from big industry. And I often wish that that was the approach that was had been taken rather than an ETS. It would have been much simpler, far more transparent for New Zealanders, for citizens. I
Yes.
often quip that there's only about three people in all of New Zealand that actually entirely understands the ETS. It's so darn complicated. And I actually don't think that's good for democracy, frankly. And I think a carbon tax would have been far less costly to administer. I think a lot of, money is chewed up just administering the ETS, which is not actually very effective. And just some final thoughts, if I may, Lindsay. I work in the space of transport, and as listeners probably know, that's our single biggest emitting sector. But it's also a fantastic example of where lower emissions measures also bring huge benefits to human health, the economy, and our environment. So by investing more aggressively in public transport and building houses, building homes around existing amenities and public transport, we can and could greatly reduce the need for private vehicle use and also lower costs for households and make people much healthier because they're using their bodies to move around. And finally, also by investing, again, still on transport, by investing more in rail and putting the right pricing in place to encourage the use of rail for freight, we would remove trucks from the road, which create a huge burden on the ratepayer and taxpayer due to the damage that increasingly heavy trucks do to our roads in the form of potholes, which are almost entirely that damage is almost entirely by trucks, not by light vehicles. They are also responsible for the lion's share of air pollution, which prematurely kills between 2,000 and 3,000 New Zealanders every year and makes thousands more sick from re respiratory illness and other diseases. So that would be my that's there are my policy.
I'm going to say to listeners, please go back and replay that section and keep it in mind when you're going to voting. And just a few little pickup points, if I may. First of all, I mentioned Christina Hood. I wouldn't like to put her in the situation of me saying, oh, Christina agrees with everything. In particular, one of the things she said was, and it relates to your mitigation comments, Catherine. New Zealand really needs the Paris Agreement to work. We don't want to be on the receiving end of uncontrolled climate disaster. So she was very strong on that. Picking up on heavy trucks, I have an element of sympathy for the heavy transport sector, not because I disagree with what you said, but we make them indispensable in our system. But the damage they cause on the roads, and I'm sure you know this, is sometimes framed as the fourth power rule. And that means that if you have a truck that weighs even just 10 times the mass or weight of a car, it causes 10,000 times the amount of damage. So it's a staggering ratio, isn't it? And my final point, Catherine, is I'd like to put in the plug for well-connected urban cycleways as well, which I think often have a really good return on investment, don't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. And just on that point you made though about I 100% agree too that yeah, that fourth power rule, that's crazy, isn't it? And I struggle to get my head around that, but exactly. And in terms of your comment, Lindsay, on heavy trucks, you're 100% right. And this is an example of where the system is broken and the system, we need transformative system change. The reason why we have so many trucks on the road is that we insist on things, this just-in-time delivery system. We order something on Amazon or Temu and we expect it to be on our doorstep the very next day. And I think we need to move to a more just-in-case system where it's more about resilience. We have stocks of the things that we need locally in case of supply chain disruption, and we lower our expectations about ordering something online and having it to us. So we are part of the problem, and then but we are also locked into a system that has created this behavior and expectation in us. So that is all my way of saying I agree with your comment. Yeah.
And can I tell you a quick story which reinforces what you just said? Back in the beginning of April, I went with my family over to Waiheke Island. And so I chartered a minibus over there, and it was just after the Straits of Hormuz, the first closure was biting. And I said to the minibus driver, "How's he going for fuel? What's this fuel planning like?" And he said, "Well, for him, it was much the same as usual, but," he said, I know there are trucks that come over here to Waiheke Island that are feeling it." And he said, "Now Waiheke's got a base population of 9,000." He said, "Every day, two trucks ferry over to deliver Temu products."
There you go. 100%.
Very few of those are necessities of life, aren't they?
100%. So exactly, which comes back to the theme of overconsumption and this habit we've got into of buying stuff that we think we need, but we actually don't if it came to the crunch, right? But yeah, this is the system. This is the system we're locked into.
Is this a time for us to move on to your book, Uncommon Land?
Absolutely. Great. Yes,
So
great time.
I'd like to leave it to you to take us through as much of the idea of it and key points and so on as you feel like, because it's home territory for you, Catherine.
Yeah, so just in case readers are not aware of this book, this is my latest book. I published it last year. I was very, very fortunate and privileged and honoured that it was longlisted in the Ockham Book Awards. So with the book, through the lens of my ancestors' stories, I explore histories of enclosure, resource exploitation, and denaturing that characterize the colonization of New Zealand, and also Ireland and other lands. And ultimately, though, the book is a story of potential, of the wisdom that can be drawn from our ancestors' experience, especially the wisdom of the commons, to help shape a more regenerative, resilient, and equitable future. Last year, especially, I kind of did an Uncommon Land book tour, and I was really overwhelmed by the level of interest in the book and the desire for people to use the stories as a sort of a just basically as a platform. Again, almost like a seeding statement for to explore this. And so I traveled, I went to fabulous places. Mata Mata was a particular favorite, and so on. And I did feel I was really felt again really lucky that the book seemed to chime with people, seemed to resonate with people, and this was across the spectrum. I think this was because it sits at that intersection between ancestral, family history, which many people have an interest in. At the intersect of that sort of family history and ancestral history with the broader social and economic history, and then the big challenges that we face today. So, and I think that, and it was a way of an unchallenging way for people to come to this conversation about where we are today, the sort of human predicament today, and also how we need to think about the future. And I mean, the great news is kind of, except it creates work for me, is that the book is almost nearly sold out. And so I will need to look at doing another print run. So that's That's the
Listen, that's a
downside.
nice problem to have, isn't
Exactly, yeah. But I've been so busy, Lindsay, with, the symposium and so on. I haven't
it?
actually got to that. So that's on my list of to-dos.
And if I touch base on your reflections at the end, for example, it picks up on what you've just been saying, and you almost give a two-pronged conclusion out of it. This is how I read it, is that we need a systems change and we need an attitudinal change. Would you like to elaborate a little bit on those, Catherine?
Yeah, so absolutely. And I think this relates to your question. I think maybe I kind of tie this up with the question you had about it being election year as well. It
Yeah.
actually links in with that quite well. And the sort of broader climate and message around the poly crisis that you want that it would be great to share with listeners. So yes, on that, one of the things that I'd really that came through as a very, very strong theme at the symposium too, actually, is that taking responsibility, as individuals for our own climate and ecological footprint is absolutely critical. But where we get the transformational shifts that we need is going to be through system change, which we've sort of already touched on already. And this requires us to mobilize our power as citizens, not just as consumers or individuals, but as citizens. And I believe that we need to be really clear to politicians about what we need to support societal well-being and a resilient future, and what we expect from government in that respect. For instance, because I work in transport, to take the transport lens again, people can't take public transport instead of a car if there isn't any public transport. It's a simple fact. People can't go and build their own buses or trains just because they want to. This requires government. Whether we like it or not. And so it takes government investment. Similarly, we can't live near amenities and the things we need, your schools and, whether it be churches, supermarkets, whatever, if there are no affordable housing options to do so. And we are forced, as many people are, to live in car dependent suburbia, a long distance away from.
Totally.
So again, this is an example of, yes, personal choice is important, but we need government to be making the right investment decisions. And also, to a great extent, having the right rules and regulations in place to, again, incentivize the private sector to be doing the things we need as society. Another example of this, Lindsay, is it's really hard to avoid, for example, throwing appliances and household goods away if there is no avenue to repair them. If there's no legislation enforcing the right to repair or putting in place high standards for importers and for manufacturers, again, this requires government legislation, government regulation. The second thing that I was really keen, on this question about, again, it's election year and what do we want? What do we want to be saying? About what needs to be done? Again, this was a really central theme at the symposium, was calling out this pernicious myth that the government is like a household, and like a household must balance its books. And this is what I call a convenient untruth. It is a narrative that support that suits neoliberal ideology of small government, less regulation, and leaving it to the private sector to deliver on the things that people need. That may work for some things, but it certainly doesn't work for climate mitigation or adaptation. It doesn't work for environmental protection. It doesn't work for public health. So the market is not going to deliver on those things. In fact, it does quite the opposite, as we know. It creates a lot of damage in those spaces. So instead, we need to be telling politicians that we understand the truth. That the only real constraint on government investment in the things society needs is real resources. That's things like energy, skilled people, concrete, steel, those sort of the machinery, those sort of real resources, not money, which government creates every time it spends. So that would be my two things, that we need collective action and to mobilize our power, which is huge. Our power as citizens mobilizes citizens and really push for system change. And the other one is that we must not take the excuse that we're often hearing, especially from this government, oh, we'd like to invest more in public health, or we'd like to invest more in climate mitigation, but we can't afford to. It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. We can't afford not to.
Look, once again, Catherine, thank you. That was a very direct and hard-hitting series of statements, and we really need that. And it's in fitting, is in keeping with the concept of the reality of everything. We are drawing to a close here. I don't want to finish without making sure that people who have been listening know how they can tap into the recordings, or if they're interested in the Polis program unfolding. Can you please give us a few details there?
Absolutely. So the best place to go to get any updates is to go to the Reality of Everything website, which is all one word, realityofeverything.org. And if people forget that, just Google Reality of Everything NZ and it will pop up. And there's an option, there's a contact form there so you can get in touch. You can also there's a mailing list where we send out updates every month or so, so you can get on the mailing list. So yeah, lots of options there.
And there they will be able to stream every one of the morning's presentations, won't they?
Exactly right. And not only that, there are the transcripts are there. That can be downloadable as PDFs, and also the key points. So it's a really succinct summary of the key points from each talk.
Fantastic. And great. Well, finally, before we wrap up, you're not somebody just to sit still and think, okay, I've done the reality of everything. Now I'm going to stop. So what's next on the radar for Catherine Knight?
And it's really important to emphasize too that we at no point envisaged the Reality of Everything symposium being a one-day thing. Yes, the symposium was on one day, but it was actually all about that being the starting point. Again, a sort of a seeding of further conversation and action. I've been really, really busy, Lindsay, with building on the momentum created by the symposium. Responding to requests for events and so on, making the necessary resources available, some of which we've already talked about, to enable communities, sector groups, towns, and regions to lead these conversations themselves. And just to note there too, if anyone's listening that really wants to be part of something transformational, we are on the search for funding partners to help us amplify this initiative. So at the moment, it's basically just me with no real funding. So would really appreciate if anyone is interested in supporting this initiative to get in touch. So another thing that we've already touched on is the Polis survey. So I will not be, I'll be sort of on the sidelines and helping to. It'll be, spearheaded by Anne and Catherine, as I mentioned, our experts. But I'm going to be very active in rolling out and communicating about that to people, and helping to create the resources and so on. And personally, I'm really excited to learn more about, the potential, the potency, and the power of deliberative democracy, because I think we're going to need more of this in the future. As one of those seeding statements encapsulated that, our current democratic systems are not working well for complex issues. So I'm really excited about learning more about that. And I guess another thing I just thought it might worthy of mention. I also, as I perhaps touched on, I work in policy, strategic policy at a regional level, regional government level. And my dream would be for my day job, that job, and my spare time job, and spare time in quote marks, to converge in both creating the space for leadership to support our country to transition towards a more resilient future, with human well-being and not unsustainable growth at its fulcrum. So that would be my dream, that they kind of merge into one thing. And often people ask about books, you know, am I going to write another book? Well, no, we're still hoping. We have been having a conversation with BWB Books about creating a BWB text around just capturing the amazing expert talks, bookended with, you know, thinking about, you know, the broader conversation about the poly crisis. So we're still hoping that we'll get that to happen. If people want to see a book produced and want BWB to produce it, can I suggest they get in contact with BWB and say that's Bridget Williams Books and tell them we must have this book and then we'll get it to them. And but personally, I have no book plans at this point, but I did have an idea for a book that I had created a proposal for, and I'd love to hear what your listeners think. Explaining in simple terms for young people, you know, for sort of mid-teens through to I guess late teens, early 20s perhaps, for young people explaining in simple terms about the planetary predicament, the economic system, how it's connected so much intrinsically with the economic system and what they need to know. And this book I tentatively in my proposal called It's the Planet, Stupid.
Great, great concept, a great title. And so if they want to let you know, Catherine.
Well, probably the easiest way, to be honest, is through, again, through the website. Let's not complicate matters with handing out. Yeah,
Okay.
so they can do that via the website, the contact form, and it will reach me. So yeah,
Ideal.
any thoughts on that?
Oh, tremendous. Oh, I've so enjoyed our conversation. As always, it's been really great. I do want to give you a special thanks for your terrific effort and deserved success on the symposium. It really, I was there, as you know, and it was very special. So thanks for that. Thanks for making time to join us, and I look forward to when we intersect in the future.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Well, Catherine knows this stuff, doesn't she? What a mover and shaker in the climate space. Next week, we have another mover and shaker in a very different sphere. John Laing is a Kiwi barrister in London. He is a climate consultant. He's an associate of Oxford Net Zero, and he's also a graphic artist. What a wonderful guest he will be. And then following that, we have a very different interview with members of Lighthouse Aotearoa, a youth group focusing on climate initiatives. I do hope I have your company for those episodes. And as always, kia kaha for the climate.
This podcast was brought to you by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air. Other great local podcasts are available through our website, freshfm.co.nz.